Last week we were following the Maccabean family after the Maccabean revolt, and you remember that the revolt was begun by a priest by the name of Mattathias in a small village outside of Jerusalem, and his three sons subsequently took up the revolt. First, Judas Maccabeus, from whom we get the name Maccabees, and then his brother Jonathan, and then his brother Simon. And we went through those individuals last time. And that was about 32 years of time from when the revolt started till the end of Simon's life. And that's pretty much, I believe, what's covered in the book of 1 Maccabees. That's where 1 Maccabees ends. And then Simon had secured independence, and now we're at 141 BC. So Jewish independence was finally secured under Simon. And then we passed on to the subsequent generations. And we covered the first of those individuals, the man by the name of John Hyrcanus, who was Simon's son. And we'll pick up right there at John Hyrcanus this morning. We covered how he succeeded his father. And you might recall that his actions began to strain the relationship with the Jewish people. So up till now, the sons of Mattathias had pretty much been in good favor with the Jewish people. And at this point, we pass on to the next generation and we begin to see some tensions and some conflicts between what the ruler was doing versus the desires of the people. So we mentioned that he was the first Jewish leader to mint his own coins with his image on them. He also hired foreign mercenary soldiers, imitating the rulers of the Seleucids. We mentioned that he opened David's tomb in order to get money to pay off both the Seleucids as well as his mercenary soldiers. And then finally, we noted that because of all these things and what was happening, the Pharisees now come on the scene and began to openly oppose the priesthood of the Hasmoneans, going as far as demanding that Hyrcanus resign as the high priest. A couple interesting things here. First is that we see the rise of the parties here, the parties within Judaism. This is the first extant reference to the Pharisees in Josephus. And we also then see the Sadducees come on the scene here because Hyrcanus shifted his loyalty from the Pharisees over to the Sadducees, which we had the quote here that they were from the wealthy priestly nobility, state-supporting, and more prepared to make religious compromises to further their economic interests. So basically, you can think of the Pharisees as a more conservative group that is trying to uphold both the written and the oral tradition, the laws of Moses, and then the Sadducees, who were more from a wealthy elite family, who were more willing to align themselves with the rulers of the day. And that's kind of the difference that you'll see in this conflict that we see all the way down into the New Testament. So at that point, I think that's where we ended last time. We see sort of the deterioration of the relationship of the Hasmonean leaders in the Jewish population. And Hyrcanus died and his son Aristobulus took over. And you can see that on your family tree there. You can see Hyrcanus and then underneath there you see two sons, Aristobulus and Alexander Janaeus. So the one on the left there is Aristobulus. He had a very brief period of rule. He was only in his office for 1 year. But he was the son of John Hyrcanus and probably was the first to take the title of king. Just hold that in your mind. We'll talk about that more in a minute. One thing I wanted to mention is that what happened with Hyrcanus, I think last time I mentioned that the Pharisees began to openly oppose the priesthood of the Hasmoneans. And the Hasmoneans were from a priestly family. If you remember, Mattathias was a priest in the village of Modin, but they weren't from the Zadokite line. And so, although they were from a priestly family, they weren't from the Zadokite line. And so, the Pharisees and the more conservative Jews had begun to oppose them as grabbing the priesthood. Not only that, but as we get further down here, we'll see that they began to adopt the practices of basically of secular rulers And so you can imagine that they're going to begin to oppose them for that as well. And we basically see things kind of going from bad to worse here. We see political intrigue that we've seen in the other rulers, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Now we start to see it here in the family of the Hasmoneans. I mentioned last week that was pretty notably absent in the first generation. The first generation, Judas, Jonathan, and Simon, seem to sort of reluctantly take the leadership in order to oppose the people that were oppressing them, the Seleucids, and to defend the traditional Jewish religion. You don't really see any evidence, at least as far as I'm aware, of any conflict among the brothers. But here, when we get to the next generations, we begin to see the same kinds of political intrigue that you have in typical secular rulers. And we'll see that here with Aristobulus. So he was the son of John Hyrcanus, and first to take the title of king, probably. Now Hyrcanus had left in his will that his wife would become the political ruler, and his eldest son, Aristobulus, would become high priest. So what do you think Aristobulus does the minute his dad dies? He puts his brothers and his mother in prison and locks them up. And it's pretty serious. He put his brothers in prison. He put his mother in prison because she had been named as the political ruler. And he not only put them in prison, but he allowed his mother to die of starvation in prison so that she would not assume political leadership. And so here you see basically political intrigue and conflict, just like you see in a secular ruler. Now, he did allow one of his brothers, his favorite brother, Antigonus, to not be in prison, and he actually became the military leader. But because his brother Antigonus was the military leader, he began to be viewed as a threat to the throne, because the military leader has control of the army, and you know, you see that over and over again in world history, how the military leader has a lot of power. And basically, I won't tell the whole story, but basically what happened was he was convinced by his advisors that his brother was a threat to him, and he sort of unwittingly arranged his murder. And basically his wife schemed, and he had his brother coming to meet him under a pretext of talking, and some other people twisted the sign that he was giving his brother so that he came. Basically, if he came a certain way, he was going to be accepted. If he came another way, he was going to kill him. And he had arranged so his brother came the right way so that they would be on friendly terms. And the schemers twisted it and got the reverse message to his brother, who came in his full military garb, which was a sign for him to be killed. So, but that's why I say he sort of unwittingly arranged for his brother's murder. You can read the story in Josephus if you want more details. It's actually a good story, but yes, John. Right. So just a comment for the tape, that Jesus' life and death is pretty much exactly the opposite of what's going on here with being a servant king. And you can see here the complete opposite, trying to power grab at all costs, including murdering your own family members, which of course is a common theme throughout world history. And we'll see more of that coming up here. And you really want to talk about that antithesis when we get to King Herod. That's where it's pretty obvious. And we'll talk about Herod coming up here. Yes, so Aristobulus unwittingly caused the death of his brother Antigonus, and he died after only 1 year. Actually, I think when his brother was murdered, he was already on his sickbed. He died after 1 year. Josephus adds the editorial version of this that says that he died over remorse over the murder of his brother, which may have been true because he really was not, you know, trying to kill his brother. He was basically duped into doing that by his advisors and his wife. But at any rate, his brutal behavior towards his own family, I have a quote here from Forster that says that it shows that the Hasmoneans had by this time become completely transformed into Oriental despots. And that's exactly the kind of pattern that we begin to see here. So following his death, his widow is by the name of Salome Alexandra, and you'll see her on the chart there next to Alexander. After Aristobulus' death, his widow freed his captive brothers from prison and named the eldest, Jonathan, as the ruler. Jonathan then married her, married his brother's widow. There is some discussion about the identity of Salome. I think most people do believe that this was the widow of his brother. He married her, and then he took the Greek form of his name, which is Janaeus, and added Alexander to it. Even if you just look at your sheet, you'll notice that the first generation has all essentially Hebrew names, and then after that you begin to see Greek names. And so this brother, his name was Jonathan, but he's known by his Greek name, Janaeus, and then he adds Alexander to it. You can imagine where Alexander comes from. That's definitely a Greek name. And then he's married to Alexandra. And if you just look down the sheet there, you'll see the same names pop up over and over again, which makes it a little bit confusing if you're trying to keep people straight. At any rate, remember that this ruler is the high priest at this point. So Janaeus is the high priest. You remember from the Bible that it's against the Jewish law for a priest to marry his brother's widow. So that's one thing that he's done here that is against the Jewish law. Now, I mentioned that taking the title of king earlier with his brother, Janaeus officially took the title king and further expanded the kingdom now. So now through his expansion efforts, the kingdom is basically growing close to the size of the monarchy, what it was under David and Solomon especially. So politically, the nation is getting larger and there's a lot of success in bringing it back to the size of the monarchy. Religiously, however, there's a complete decline here. So his taking the official title of king would have also been viewed as illegitimate since he was not, of course, of the Davidic line. His rule, more than his predecessors, began to be modeled after the ways of the Seleucid rulers previous to him, and he moved back now towards Hellenization, which is, you know, sort of the reverse of what his forefathers, the Maccabeans, had been trying to accomplish. They had been pushing and revolting against Hellenization. He started to move back that way again. And I have a quote here from Abraham Shallet that says, "His whole career as statesman, as soldier, and conqueror is testimony to the fact that his strongest character trait was an unbridled lust for power." So you can see from these quotes that I'm starting to collect that you can see where this family is headed, and the common theme here is a lust for power. So, successful politically at expanding the country, but a lot of internal trouble is brewing here. You remember back under John Hyrcanus, the Pharisees come on the scene and began to openly oppose him. Well, here, under Janaeus Alexander, the conflict with the Pharisees basically led to civil war. The Pharisees began to really come out in opposition to what was going on here. They openly opposed him because he was of his bad character. He had a reputation for drunkenness. He was desiring to rule as a secular Hellenized king. And then, again, polarizing the parties more and more, because the Pharisees were opposed to him, he aligned himself with the Sadducees completely. The Sadducees supported his Hellenized approach to rule and his desire to expand his kingdom. And so you see this big polarization happening now between the Pharisees and the Sadducees in terms of not only their religious beliefs, but it's starting to be a political thing now where the ruler is aligning himself with one or the other of these parties. In this case, the last two rulers strongly with the Sadducees. The Sanhedrin actually comes on the scene here as well. The Sanhedrin was, of course, the Jewish ruling body, and we know about that from the New Testament. They had likely emerged around this time as the governing political body. It was largely under the control of the Sadducees at this point in time, with the Pharisees being marginalized, again, because of the political infighting. Now, Janaeus's reign was characterized by violence and civil war. If you read the records here, this is largely from Josephus' Antiquities, Book 13. There are multiple incidents of him slaughtering the population of people that opposed him. So the one thing you want to remember here is that the Pharisees were the favorite of the common people. the common people really aligned themselves with the Pharisees because they were the upholders of the Mosaic Law. And you can see the general population more related to the Pharisees than the Sadducees. So there are several incidents where there were uprisings and he slaughtered people. There's one major incident recorded where he was offering a sacrifice and he poured the water out at the base of the altar rather than on the altar during a sacrifice. And that was viewed as the wrong way to do a sacrifice. And there's actually another small detail in there that some writers don't pick up on, is that he was actually following the Sadducean manner of the sacrifice rather than the Pharisaic method. So there's a hint of that disagreement here too. But at any rate, he did it in a way that offended the people. And the story goes that the people actually began pelting him with citrons, which completely humiliated him. And so what did he do? He called in the army and started slaughtering people. So that was his response. There was a huge incident where he slaughtered many of the Jews who were trying to uphold what was viewed as the traditionally right way to do the sacrifices. Now, another clue as to how bad it was during his reign is that his own people appealed to the Seleucid ruler, at the time it was Demetrius, to come to their aid and actually attack their own ruler. So that shows you how bad things had gotten, where they're actually appealing to a foreign ruler to come and militarily intervene in their country. And so you can get the picture here that Janaeus was a fairly corrupt character. I have a quote here from F.F. Bruce from his New Testament history that I'll read. This is about Janaeus. He showed no concern for anything but personal power and military conquest. In his unquenchable thirst for this way of life, he hazarded his nation's independence more than once, exhausted the national wealth, and forfeited the respect and goodwill of the best elements in the nation. So you can see here a steady decline in the Hasmonean rulers at this point. He died at a relatively early age, at the age of 49, probably from a disease related to his over-drinking, drinking too much. So what's very interesting about his death here is he realized upon his death that the people were siding with the Pharisees and he had sided with the Sadducees. So he was kind of leaving his kingdom at this point, if you want to call it that, in a sort of precarious situation for the next ruler. So he actually counseled his wife, Salome, to reconcile with the Pharisees after his death because of their influence over the general population. So that's a very interesting twist of events at the end of his life. He recognized that he really needed to be reconciled with the Pharisees. So his wife, after his death, his wife, Salome Alexandra, assumed control. This is now in 76 BC, so we're getting closer and closer to the reign of Herod. And she reigned for 9 years until her death 9 years later in 67 BC. She did exactly what he had counseled her to do. She made peace with the Pharisees. So because of making peace with the Pharisees, and she restored them to a prominent position over the Sadducees, because of that, her reign is sort of viewed as a golden age for the Pharisees, where they were restored back to their position in the Pharisaic tradition. She also restored the Pharisees to power in the Sanhedrin, so that they now have a position of influence in the council, the ruling council. And she had two sons, so if you look on your family tree there, you'll see two sons, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. Now, Aristobulus was a person who was very ambitious, and he became the military leader. Her elder son, Hyrcanus, was relatively unambitious and didn't really want to be the military leader or the ruler, and he became the high priest. So that's sort of the arrangement that they came to upon her death. Actually, this was before she died. This was the arrangement that happened before she died. So she was the political leader, Aristobulus was the military leader, and Hyrcanus was the high priest. Well, Aristobulus began championing the cause of the Sadducees. So he began to oppose his mother, the queen, and began to position himself to be in military power when she died. So even before she died, he was positioning himself in a position of power to be able to take over after her death. And again, he was aligning himself with the Sadducees. Now, at her death, basically a power struggle ensued. Now, Hyrcanus, by all accounts, seems to not have been ambitious at all. Like, he didn't really want to fight with his brother over all this stuff. But his followers, you know, they had these parties now where some people were in his camp, some people were in Aristobulus' camp. And at the death of Salome, a power struggle ensued between their followers, and Aristobulus, who was the ambitious one, gained the upper hand and basically came to an agreement, an interesting agreement with Hyrcanus. And the agreement was that he would take over as the high priest and the ruler, and Hyrcanus would just retire to private life. We'll see how well that works out later, but imagine a prince, it's difficult for a prince to just go into retirement as a private citizen. But that's the arrangement that they came to. They actually switched houses, and Aristobulus moved into the palace. Hyrcanus moved into a common house. I'm sure it was a nice house, but moved into a common house. So that's kind of the state of affairs that we have here, sort of getting towards the end of the Hasmonean dynasty at this point. And then we'll see here some interesting changes will happen at this point. But before I go there, are there any questions or comments up till now? Yes, Jen. The question is there any evidence in the writings of genuine religious expression and hope and prayer and things like that? I've thought a little bit about this. There is a lot of evidence of piety in this whole period. The problem is that, this is my personal opinion at this point, the problem from my perspective is we don't have any authoritative word on what's true religion and what isn't true religion. When we look back at the Old Testament, there's always a mixture of true and false religion. And even in the New Testament, there's a mixture of true and false religion. Look at the Pharisees and their traditions. And if we didn't have the testimony of Jesus and the testimony of the New Testament, what would our view be of what the Pharisees were doing? It's hard to tell. It looks very pious from the outside, but of course we all know it's what's going on inside that makes the difference, which is of course exactly what Jesus exposed in his teaching. So the problem as I see it here is there's lots of external evidence of piety in people trying to do the right thing, like the Pharisees here opposing the rulers when they were basically going against the Jewish law. You know, that seems like a good thing. Were those people part of the remnant or not? That's a harder question to answer. So it's very difficult, I think, to determine who are the true believers in all of this mess. We know there were true believers because we find that at the opening. Yeah, well, at the opening to the New Testament, we begin to see some of the Old Testament believers who were true believers. And we think of the parents of John the Baptist, you know, Zechariah. And you think of Simeon and Anna in the temple when Jesus was born. There's probably other examples we could mention, but there's definitely a remnant here that are true believers, but it's kind of hard to tell because we don't have an authoritative word. We have to interpret. Right, yes, there is a lot of literature. We actually, I think literature might be next on the topic, or it's coming up on the outline, it's coming up soon. There's a whole body of literature that was written during this period. And then you see these groups. We've already seen the beginning of some of the groups here, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then there's other groups. There's the Essenes, the Zealots. And then we have the whole sort of mystery of the Qumran community, people who were so disgusted with what was happening in Jerusalem that they actually moved out to the desert to get away from it. So there's definitely a body of piety and resistance there, but asking the question about who were the true believers is a little hard to answer, I think. It seems to me like the true believers, the remnant, if you will, would have been aligning themselves more with these conservative groups, you know, but exactly how they worked in there, it's hard to tell. We'll talk more about that, though, coming up. We will be talking about the Qumran community a little bit. Yeah. Yes, Ginny. The question is, where were the scrolls of the Old Testament, and were they using them to teach? I think probably yes. I mean, the scrolls were around. At this point, I think there's evidence that there were multiple copies of the Old Testament around. We know prior to this and up to this time, the Old Testament was being translated into Greek in Egypt at the time, in Alexandria. So there were definitely copies of the scrolls. And the story with the translation of the Septuagint was that they came and got a copy of the Old Testament scrolls from Jerusalem. And it was during this period. It was a little earlier than where we are here, but there's definitely copies of the scrolls. And then we also know from historical records that there were copies of the scrolls in Qumran at this point in time too, probably almost the whole Bible, if not the whole Old Testament. So the word is still there, and there's definitely people that were trying to follow it and teach it. But there's a lot of conflicting forces, you know, Hellenization and people trying to use the high priesthood as a political office now, and a lot of manipulation and a lot of temptation, I think, by people. So the folks who were really trying to retain the law and teach it were under a lot of pressure at this point in time, I think. That's probably the case of, you know, Mattathias and his sons were probably true followers of the law who basically had had enough at that point and started the revolt. Yes, Dave. The question is, did the Sanhedrin just kind of pop up here? And what would the warrant be for that from the Old Testament? So the first question about the Sanhedrin, I think I haven't done as much work on the Sanhedrin as I have on the other parties, but I do believe it emerged during this period. It emerged over a period of time. So by the time we start to see references to something written down with a name associated with it, it had probably been in existence in some form for some time before that. And maybe eventually people began calling it something, and then later we would begin to see it written in the literature. So it did seem to emerge over this period. You might ask, what's the warrant for any of these groups or parties? I'm not sure that there's, you know, that you would ever point to a biblical warrant for any of these parties, but it was more of a, I look at it as more of a historical expediency that they had to start aligning themselves with one party or the other. And so it's just, I think, sort of organically these groups would grow who would be of like mind. It's probably not that much different from denominations, you know, today, where maybe that's not a great example, but you do have differences of opinions. And even with, so you, to carry that a little bit further, who are the true believers in the denominations? If you want to use denominations in the broadest sense, as I think that guy in that handbook back there on the shelf does, there's a pretty wide list of religious groups in that handbook of denominations, and some of them would definitely not even be true Christians. And then others, you know, if you go from the left all the way over to the right, you've got a huge body of people over to the right who would be considered true believers and have differences of doctrine. So it's a little bit like this, you know, you've got sort of a spectrum of people from maybe the zealots all the way on the right-hand side, you know, to the Sadducees or even the Hellenizers on the left. So there's a wide range of beliefs, and people begin to align themselves with people who are like-minded and whom they have common ground with, I think. Hopefully some of this discussion is helpful, because we're setting the stage for when Jesus came on the scene. You can see all of the political baggage that was happening at the time. There's a political and there's a lot of religious concepts and things that are, you know, really diametrically opposed from what the Old Testament was really getting at. And Jesus brings that corrective and says, you know, basically, you're all wrong, you know, my kingdom is not of this world. And, you know, you think about the many conversations with the Pharisees on how, you know, you're washing the cup on the outside, but the inside is filthy. You can see the seeds of all of that right here in what we're looking at this point in time. And so hopefully that's one of the helpful things that we'll get out of this, is really understanding the context of Jesus coming on the scene and the types of things that he was talking about and opposing. Yes, Pastor. Yes, thanks for that note. The note was that the idea of a ruling elders council was a localized concept, and I forget the exact criteria. I think it was 10 in the local assembly. And then that was called a Sanhedrin, sort of with a little s. And then when we have the Great Sanhedrin, which is what we encounter in the New Testament in Jerusalem, that would be sort of like the higher-up presbytery, if you will, or general assembly. And I can't recall, again, how many people were in that. It was either 50 or 100, I think, in the Great Sanhedrin. In the local assemblies, it was directly connected to the synagogue as well. We'll talk about that later, but you see some of the roots of the Christian church in the way the synagogue was organized with elders and even the worship in the synagogue. Yeah, so all that stuff is developing. All those things that we encounter in the New Testament and that are really foundations for the church are found, you know, in this period of time. Okay, let's try to finish this section off today. We've got about 5 or 10 minutes left here. Oh, so I mentioned some interesting things happen now. So we've got these two lines set up, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, these two brothers. And now a very interesting outsider comes on the scene. And this is an Idumean politician by the name of Antipater. Idumea on your map, if you think of where Judea is, sort of west of the Dead Sea, Idumea is south of there. It's a territory just south of there. So that was the territory that would have been a mixture of Jewish people as well as people from Edom. So if you remember where Edom is, it's kind of east of there. And so you see this mixture of people there. Sometimes when you hear of an Idumean in your, like maybe in your study Bible, it will also mention Edom in that. At any rate, we find an interesting character come on the scene here by the name of Antipater. He sided with Hyrcanus, sort of the weaker of the two brothers, and he aligned himself with the growing power of Rome. So Rome is coming on the scene now, and we'll talk about that in our next section, actually, the growing power of Rome. But Rome, by this time, had assumed control of Syria, that's up north, and was now basically the new world power in control of the Mediterranean basin. So just to give a very brief summary of what happened here leading up to the invasion in 63 BC, we'll talk about this in more detail in the next section, but basically both brothers went to the Roman general Pompey, who was going to adjudicate between the two brothers. Now, Aristobulus is representing himself. Actually, there was another man, a lawyer, who was talking for him, but he was basically putting himself forward. Hyrcanus, you get the impression, was kind of being pushed forward by Antipater at this point in time because he was working behind the scenes and aligning himself with Rome. And he was sort of using Hyrcanus as his face and his foil. You know, he saw an opportunity here to work through a Hasmonean leader to begin to exert some political authority. So they both came to the Roman general Pompey. And we'll talk later about what happened with all this. But the Roman general Pompey originally favored Aristobulus and putting him in charge. But Aristobulus basically angered Pompey by not obeying what he commanded him to do. So Pompey, as you can imagine, was not probably long on patience and went right after Aristobulus, took the battle to Jerusalem. Now, Aristobulus actually surrendered to Pompey and went to him. But his followers, I mentioned the followers before, and this is, you know, you always have these movements and you've got these big groups of people following someone. Even though Aristobulus had surrendered, his followers refused to surrender and they took refuge in the temple fortress. Well, Pompey besieged and captured the temple in 63 BC, effectively ending Jewish independence once and for all at this point in time. So Hyrcanus and his followers had sided with Pompey, and Hyrcanus was therefore rewarded after the conquest of Jerusalem by being assigned as the high priest. So basically, Pompey reinstalled him as the high priest, but did not give him any political authority at this point in time. The Romans were in charge now. Hyrcanus was later confirmed as the high priest by Julius Caesar in 47 BC. So we're going to see this continuation of the battle of these two brothers and their descendants for another generation or so. We'll talk about that very briefly. But let's pause here and summarize where we are at this point. So the Maccabees had achieved one of their main goals, which was their first main goal was to reestablish freedom of worship for Jews. They had definitely succeeded in doing that by overthrowing the Seleucid rulers. Furthermore, they went further in winning political freedom as well. Their political freedom lasted some 60 years, so they had Jewish independence for some 60 years before the Romans had to intervene in the civil war. But as you can see here, we see an ongoing corruption of the political office with the later Hasmonean rulers. The rulers up through Simon, that is, you know, Judas, Jonathan, and Simon, the brothers, were considered wise political leaders, although maybe they had begun to demonstrate some of the tendencies of Seleucid rulers around them. Definitely the followers, the successors of Simon, the next generations, were of lesser character and began to really embrace the practices of corrupt rulers. And we saw even under the case of Jannaeus persecuting their own people and slaughtering their own people when they didn't agree with them. So we see a growing corruption of the political office. We also see a pretty substantial corruption of the priesthood. And we begin to see Jewish responses to this. We already mentioned before that the Zadokite line had already moved to Egypt. So the true Zadokite line, represented by Ananias IV, had moved to Leontopolis in Egypt. And you remember we talked about the fact that a temple was built there where the Zadokite line served. The Zadokite line served there, by the way, all the way up through the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So during the time of Jesus and the apostles, the true Zadokite line was ministering in Egypt. That's maybe something that you didn't know. I didn't know that. The assumption of the priesthood by the Hasmoneans, again, they were from a priestly family, but they were not from the line of Zadok. This would have been offensive to the pious Jews, and then particularly when the office began to be corrupted, you know, in the later Hasmonean leaders. So you can see there's a growing dislike of the Hasmoneans taking up the priesthood. It's interesting, in the Qumran documents, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are a couple of figures who people debate. There's all kinds of debates in the literature about who these figures are, but there's a teacher of righteousness that's referred to, which was most likely an early teacher within the Qumran community. There's also someone who's named the wicked priest. So you see sort of this evil person in the Qumran literature as well. Various people have been suggested as this wicked priest. Who are they talking about? And these Hasmoneans that we're just talking about are the most likely candidates for that wicked priest of the Qumran community. One person that's mentioned is Jonathan. Now remember, he was a fairly upright man, the brother of Judas. But he's been suggested as the wicked priest of the Dead Sea Scrolls because, if you remember, he accepted the title of high priest from the pagan ruler. He was named the high priest, even though, again, he wasn't from the line of Zadok. So he's been suggested. Possibly more likely is this last character, Jannaeus Alexander. He's probably the best candidate for the wicked priest because of his persecution and slaughter of the pious Jews. He actually plundered Gentile cities within Palestine. I've got a quote here from F.F. Bruce from rabbinical literature that speaks of the time when King Jannaeus put the rabbis to death. So you can see the view of Jannaeus in the rabbinical literature is quite negative. And then D.S. Russell here, an authority on this period, says, a number of scholars believe that Alexander Jannaeus is the wicked priest whose name frequently occurs in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we talked about how the Qumran community basically extracted themselves from Jerusalem altogether because they were so disgusted with what was happening with the priesthood. And here's evidence of this, you know, wicked priest, probably referring to one of the later Hasmonean rulers. Maybe we'll close on this. I have one additional quote here from F.F. Bruce, New Testament History. And this is talking about some of the different parties. The Hasidim were not greatly enamored of the Hasmoneans' assumption of the high priesthood for themselves. The Pharisees tolerated the situation under protest. The community of Qumran found it so intolerable that they withdrew from association with a temple and administration defiled by a wicked or illegitimate priesthood. So you can see there the three groups and what their responses were to the priesthood of the Hasmoneans. I've got one other point here about the rise of the parties. You can kind of pick up here next week, but this period witnessed the beginnings and the first historical references to all of these parties, the Hasidim, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, of course the Qumran community, and there are a few others that we'll talk about later. But the qualities of these parties and their differences, which we find when we open the pages of the New Testament, have their roots right in this period. So this is, you know, kind of the time frame when they were coming together.